I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Angela Gabriel. She's percussionist and teacher, musician, and Amy Lindquist, who's a singer and a teacher, and they are co-directors of the Seventh Wave Community Singers. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for having us here.
So this is an experiential choir. What does that mean?
Well, it means that it's for everybody. There are no auditions. It means that we all get together and we sing together. And it's structured in that we do songs, we do chants, we do things from all over the world. It is not, you don't need to have any musical or choral experience to go in there.
And that and if I could add, it's more about the experience of being there than it is about, you know, we're here to work up something to perform later.
Yeah.
It's not about how are we doing this for the future. It's about the present moment and what we're doing together right now in time.
Yeah.
That said, do you perform?
Not yet. Now, that could come later.
Yeah.
This is, as she said, it's about the moment of singing together, that actual feeling in your body of singing together, which is what we used to do as a species. We've done it forever. And I think it's a human need to do.
Yeah.
And I also know that a lot of us have issues around our voice and around our singing voice that are pretty painful. I've seen it a lot. People come in and I ask their experience with singing and they say, well, you know, I love singing, but I don't let anyone hear it. And my sister's a singer, or when I was 5, I was told I was a bad singer and I never sang again, or these horrible stories.
They can pinpoint the moment, usually, when they decided that they couldn't sing. And it really is a decision. You know, people just kind of believe that about themselves, and it's sad because we all have that as a birthright. And
we believe that we can't.
I
mean, some people, like I, for example, I'm a terrible singer, but I can carry a tune and I can hear music.
Well, I would question that assertion. Like, why do you say that?
Yeah, what do you mean by terrible?
ask the people who live in my house with me, because I sing a lot, but you know, it's always to the dogs.
But that means that you are a singer, you know. So it doesn't really have to. When we put those adjectives before it, like I'm a terrible singer, I'm a great singer, leave that word out. You're
all
a singer.
Okay, so. My dogs don't seem to mind at all, and I make up many, many dog songs on a regular basis. But the point I was trying to make is I know, I have a very clear sense of music and tone. Some people are truly tone deaf.
No.
That's
a deception.
Extremely rare.
Really?
That you'd ever find someone tone deaf.
Let me tell you a story. I studied with Siobhan Robinson. There's a group called the Gettin' Higher Choir in Canada, in Victoria, British Columbia. And
that's a great name.
Yeah, it is a great name. And it's a huge choir. It's 350 people that get together and sing in different places. But anyway, I went up and I took a training on how to do this kind of community choir. It's a worldwide movement. A town this size in England would have probably 5 of these kind of choirs, and people get together. Brian Eno is on the train. He's written many articles about, he has people in his New York loft, and they just sing together. And it does a lot of things for people. It heals people in a lot of different ways that are even hard to explain. But you're the perfect candidate. Like, say I met you at a party, and you said exactly what you just said. I love to sing. I sing to my dogs, but, oh, I'm terrible. Okay? I get this all the time from people I know, from people I don't know. And our first time is free to come in and try it. And it's really not about you, and it is about you in a weird way. Like, you get in a group, and there are some really strong singers, some real timid singers, and it's like dolphins learning to swim. You get between 2 good singers, and you're off. And we make this incredible music. And it sounds good, because people just let go of that idea that they're whatever. They're a bad singer, a great singer.
Yeah.
I've had people come in that were soloists, that came in with a ton of ego, like, I'm going to come in here and show everybody what a great singer I am. And
like
they,
that kind of opera thing? That
well,
kind of
this
any
person,
style.
Yeah, this person was an R&B, recorded R&B soloist. And I'm a soloist as well. I have, you know, that's my background, whatever. It's not the same thing. And so that person came in and was folded in just like everybody else and had his own experience about, wow, okay, I'm harmonizing people. It's a different, it's a feeling. It's not really a, look at me, I'm so fabulous, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
None of that. And so for
and
you.
And so did he change?
He didn't. He came one time. Yeah, I didn't expect him to stay because it wasn't about the ego. It wasn't about look at him or anything. But he did stay the whole time and blended with everybody and then never came back. So whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what went on in his head. But I do know people like, you're the perfect person that we're aiming for. You're, you know.
Okay, I'll
the
be
person.
There.
You should come try it.
Yeah, you should come try it. And, you know, what I was saying before about how it's very much in the moment. I feel like, for me, I had that same feeling of, oh, no, I really can't sing. I used to love to sing. As a kid, I was singing all the time. And then I kind of got, at some point, I can't pinpoint the moment, but at some point I decided, no, I'm really not a singer. And even as a music teacher, I would do a lot more playing and way less singing. And being in this class, we just started this in November. And I personally feel, just since November, that my voice, my confidence with my voice, my honesty in my voice, and just finding an authentic voice for myself, it's like I can't even believe how much better I sound. And it might not even be that my sound has changed that much. It's more that my attitude toward myself and my judgment toward myself has changed. And but it is also that my voice has changed.
Well, we do pedagogy in the, we warm up. I talk a lot about what's going on inside. I'd studied at New England Conservatory. Jazz. I was a jazz singer all through my 20s, and I sang in Europe and did. I had a solo career. I still do, but this is about getting out of your own way, feeling it instead of listening to yourself, feeling it and listening to everybody else and the group sound. And I tell you what, I still leave there fully oxygenated, head. But it's like this feeling that I can't get anywhere else. It's kind of why I started it, because I can't sing with a group by myself. You know, I can't. It's a whole different thing. So I would say that I get better singer. I'm a self-identified singer from a young age. Everyone's like, you're a singer. Get on stage. Sing for grandma, blah, blah, blah. But that's not what this is about either. So I love it.
And also, if I could add, it's really cool because not only is it the experience of what you're doing at the moment, but then being able to learn about your voice, those things then you can take into the future. And so then the next time that you sing is even better. And so you're building on something. And I almost see it as like a yoga for the voice. You know, like you're going into this space for this time to exercise that part of you. And it's not only exercising that vocal part of you, but it's that way of connecting with other people musically.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of where the whole experiential part of it came.
It sounds a little bit like contact improv for the voice. In terms of
we do something called toning, which is part of it, and it is contact improv for the voice. The only rule is just to stay in the moment and don't judge the sound. And some of the stuff that comes out, like I went to New England Conservatory, I got my degree there, and I did a lot of contemporary classical music. Some of the stuff that we do in that situation rivals anything that I've heard written.
Really?
Yeah, and it's really layers of just getting out of your way, getting out of your way, being with other people, and then we do things like we'll learn a song. I teach orally. We both teach the songs. We sing it. They sing back. We sing it. We sing back. We tweak it. You don't have to read music to be in this choir. In fact, we don't use people are paper trained. we're off the paper, and. So it's really old school that way. And then we have this song in our repertoire. So when we're improvising, sometimes the songs come out and we do arrangements of them, spontaneous arrangements that are
beautiful.
Incredible.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
What kind of music, like what are some examples of songs that people might know that you would do?
Well, the best way I like to describe these are power songs. They're songs that give chill bumps that maybe have a use. We do songs from South Africa that they sang. In the struggle, we do.
That's some of the most beautiful harmony on
yes,
the earth.
Yes, and yeah. That's why we that's one of the main reasons this isn't an all-women's choir, because we need the low end for our South African songs, because it's, you know, it's very bass-heavy. We do songs from all over the world, chants, rounds. I start with chants and rounds to get that's instant harmony. It's easy to get into it, and then we'll do more once everybody's loose and open and listening and present. It's really easy to teach parts. last night's choir, I mean, it was amazing. There were new people. I threw out some stuff. They picked it up, and we were harmonizing on a new song in 5 minutes. It's like instant, I don't know,
and
gratification.
Even some of the songs that are, like, real, it might be one simple line, but then people have the freedom to just kind of add anything that they hear on top of it. And it's really beautiful because you can't, well, like you might hear the person next to you singing something and you'd be like, oh, that's cool. You know, I can do what that person did. And then they're doing something else. And before you know it, it turned itself into, from one line, into five parts.
And so what about the people who come in to this choir? We are talking, by the way, about the Seventh Wave Community Singers with Angela Gabriel and Amy Lindquist. What about people who come in and they're truly, I mean, they've got all this baggage from seventh grade choir where they were taught, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And they really are inhibited, and maybe they can sing notes, but they can't really improvise or be free.
Well, it's, I haven't really experienced that. My favorite story to tell is about a woman who was probably in her mid-50s, and she came in and told a story when she was 8, and she was outside and singing and free and swinging on her swing, and her auntie came out and said, "Stop it. That's awful. That sounds awful."
Aww.
And she never sang again. And she came to the choir. This was before I've workshopped this in different ways. Anyway, this was before. And she didn't sing for like 3 sessions. She listened. And then the 4th session, she got in with tears streaming down her face and sang. And it's like, that people really see by doing it that there is no spotlight on them. There's nobody judging them.
Yeah.
But that being said, there is a standard. I want people to be in pitch, and I show them how. And if they're not in pitch, I go right up to them, and I help them find it in front of everybody else. And I feel like, and I do that for everybody, and I feel like it takes the shame out of it. It's like, here we are. We're all learning to do something, and then it sounds better, and they hear it.
Yeah,
it's not like this loosey-goosey, do whatever you want. And, you know, I have had a lot of professional choristers come up and go, well, if anyone can get in, it can't sound that good. And they said, well, you just got to come hear it. Because it's coming from the heart, and because there's no shame in it, it sounds amazing.
And because the goal isn't necessarily, you know, we're going to be the best choir and we're going to go out and prove to you that we're the best choir in a performance. Again, it's about the experience. And in that room, in that moment, we sound exactly the way we're supposed to sound. And that's what's perfect about it.
That's very interesting because I personally have an allergy to things that are too loosey-goosey, like anything goes. It's just awful and boring and stupid and completely lacking in the discipline and the art, which is what it's all about. But what you're doing is also heart-centered.
Right.
And has some discipline to it.
Well, the fact is we're both trained musicians.
Yeah.
Like probably some of the highest level, quote unquote, training, you know, masters, teaching in university, blah, blah, blah. We know that scene. And I've been in it and I've seen people lose their joy of music because it's so in your head. And you have to use your head. You have to, but it's not the most important thing, I feel, in music. I had to come back around to this from the conservatory soloist, you know, pressure mode. And there's one of our biggest proponents in the choir lost her voice. She was a theater person, musical theater and choir, and got so trained that she got nodes and she couldn't sing for 10 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And she came back because she wanted to have fun singing. And I only have fun if it sounds good, ultimately, if people are really on the same page. Like, we want to make something beautiful, and I know I can help people get there. I don't, like, if somebody, we all think of that tone-deaf person we know. Oh, that person's tone-deaf. There's no way he could be in the choir or she could be in the choir. I've taught in elementary all the way through high school. I've been in the public schools teaching music for a really long time. And it's two things. It's breathing and listening, and there are ways to get it. To get there. And I will work with anybody in the choir who needs extra work to get there.
So how many people end up showing up? Does it vary a lot?
It varies because it's drop-in. We have a new space that we're really thrilled about, the Rail Yard. We're starting February 3rd to be in the Rail Yard Performance Center Sunday nights, 5:30 to 7.
Yes.
And We've been trying to find the right location. In this choir, it's been as little as one person show up, and they get a private lesson to, I've had 20 people show up. So what happens is we'll have a drop-in for a while, and a momentum might happen where people will want to commit. And if the people commit, then we'll have like a 10-week session and then do a performance, if everyone agrees.
Yeah.
But to have that performance there first, I think is scary.
Yeah.
And freaks people out.
Yeah, because then you're going to exclude the very people who
right.
you want to bring in who...
But instead of, oh my gosh, we sound so good, where can we share this? You
yeah.
know, who can we sing for? That's how they do it. That's how it started up in Canada. Now they have huge concerts for nonprofit causes, which is probably where we would go with it.
We were talking about trying to do something for hospice patients or...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing like music for people who are...
Yeah.
I mean, both in... We know about the Alzheimer's music mm-hmm. connection and people who are sick and people who are dying.
Yeah, so that's another thing. There, hospice choirs are another trend, actually, in Canada and here. And we've started moving in that direction. We're looking at that, and we have a couple of clients that we're talking to. And so I don't want to let the cat out of the bag yet, but that's an offshoot. There's also in Canada, they have this thing called SWAT, Sing When Asked To. So groups of the choir, if someone's getting married out of the choir and they want to sing at their wedding and they have people come, and it's like flash mob. They were doing flash yeah. mobs before flash mobs were hip.
Amazing.
So, yeah, it's good.
So how did you start singing, Amy?
I grew up in El Rancho in Pewaukee, and there was a choir in Santa Fe called Santa Fe Children's Choir. And they came to my school with Peter Rabbit. I was 9. I remember this. And I was like, that's what I want to do. So my mother drove me twice a week to be in the choir. And then I started singing jazz in high school. And then I went to college. And it's what I'm here to do, pretty much. I'm in a band now, a funk band called The Sticky.
The Sticky.
The Sticky, which is the most fun I've had ever in a band. But again, it's group singing. There's 3 of us. Singing,
yeah,
and we do these incredible, fun Earth, Wind, and Fire harmonies, and
nice,
yeah, it's super fun, and yeah, Angela's such a great partner in this. I'm so
now, are
psyched.
Are you also in The Sticky?
No, she I just love
band.
The Sticky.
Oh, okay. but I'm saying in this, I'm so thrilled to have Angela. She's a performing musician as well, and
right,
to have her energy in this.
Now, tell us about your performing, Angela. Are you? You're also in a band?
Yeah, my husband and I have a band called Hidden Whale.
Okay.
And then I also play with a lot of the classical groups and new music and African world groups and things like that that you might hear in town. But my singing experience, I don't really have much singing performance experience. And so I think it's kind of cool the way she and I balance each other out, because a lot of, well, especially once we get into the rail yard with that amazing dance floor that's in there, the place we were in had a concrete floor, and so we were wanting to do some kind of body percussion and gumboot moves and things like that.
Yeah.
But it was hard on that concrete floor, so we kind of let that go. And so I think we'll be able to add some of that back in now. And so we kind of balance it with the rhythmic thing on my end. And then I sometimes teach the songs too, but it's more I'm the rhythm person and she's the melody person.
Nice.
Yeah, and it switches too. We had this meeting, you know, and we both had chill bumps the whole time. So we're like, we got to do something
yeah,
here.
So
and
there's something real going on.
Yeah,
here.
And it's about getting people making music together, you know. And the singing is the first instrument, and it can go anywhere. I have no doubt that people will find us, and all kinds of instrumentalists, you know, will find us. And it's just, I'm so thrilled to be over there with Elise and Eric. I can't even tell you.
Yeah, the Rail Yard Performance Center. It's a wonderful space. How are the acoustics in there?
Live.
It'll sound really nice with our voices. I've done so many things in that room that has brought me personal growth. I mean, like, huge steps in my life, I think, I've had in that room. And so for us to be able to go and do this in that space is really special to me, because it really is a sacred space.
Yeah, there's a lot of good vibes in there.
There's a lot of...
amazing musicians.
A lot of growth that happens in that
room.
Yeah,
and dancing and all different kinds of dancing and performances that have been in there and
yeah.
people who have made connections with each other in that room. Yeah.
I know babies that I have 2 sons that are old now and they were made meeting in that room. You know, like the parents met in that room and there was magic. And I know these babies. It's like, so, yeah, I mean, Santa Fe needs more of this. It needs more connective tissue, I think. I think there are a lot of people that do their thing separately. And we're all kind of wanting to reach out to each other, and we just need a space to do that. So,
well, I think it's also kind of indicative of a larger cultural trend going on, which is people coming together, mm-hmm. and people coming together around climate change, or coming together around the environment, or politics, or art, or even in the sciences. There are people from different disciplines who were talking to each other who didn't used to, and things like that. And I think it's, if we're going to make it through the various crises that we've created culturally, we need to come together in exactly the way that you guys are talking about, which is from a place that's not just loosey-goosey, but that is real and authentic and open and not just intellectualized.
Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say music is such a perfect analogy for how we're supposed to be together as humans. And so for us to be able to come together into one space and to work collectively and to create, like literally create harmony, you know, it's something that you can take that and it affects all the other aspects of your life. And I think that as people, as a society, you know, as a community, I think it helps strengthen on every single level, from personal all the way out.
Yeah. So experiential choirs are happening all over the world? I mean, is there sort of like an association where you know what the others are doing?
Well, the people in Canada, the Get and Hire Choir people, started a choir network, and it's called Ubuntu, U-B-U-N-T-U, and it is a network for that. And they, you know, it's part of their marketing thing to push their, you know, to offer their training. But it's really a group of choirs with the same philosophy, and it is worldwide. I met people there at the training from all over the place, New Zealand and England and Africa. South Africa, community choirs were part of the impetus for the anti-apartheid movement. I mean, music has a purpose. And we're all, you know, all the crises that we face here, I believe, stem from loneliness and disconnection. From, you know, you could say from the source, from each other, da da da, and music is a direct line. You know, that being said, when you do songs from other cultures, there's a way to do it. You don't just take them. You know, there's a respectful way to connect through music that we're really aware of too. So, like, say in Canada, they do a benefit for this African village where they do a lot of their songs. They call it royalties. You know, there's ways to pull this off. And I believe anything that brings us together, that gets us working together, is really important right now. It's super vital.
What is? So. Can you tell me, Amy, what I forgot, what's the translation of Ubuntu?
Ubuntu means I am because we are.
Yeah.
Ah, very interesting.
So, yeah.
Do you have any young people? I'm thinking about this because we did a show last week about bullying, and it turns out that people who engage in bullying behavior, you're not allowed to say that they're bullies anymore, but they engage in bullying behavior.
What do we call them now?
People who engage in bullying behavior, I guess.
Bully Americans.
Right. Pushy Americans. Right.
But there are people who basically don't really have a place.
Yeah.
They can't figure out what to do with themselves. And since they haven't found what they're good at or haven't been able to develop it or whatever, it's cool to beat somebody else up and somebody else thinks that's cool, you know?
Yeah.
Get young people singing. I mean, you can't.
That was what I did in the schools. It's a really tricky environment to do it. I mean, I'd like to go back in the schools from a different place and do workshops for teachers and stuff, but, you know, with the
standards-based. What was challenging about
it? Well, the standards-based, test-based public school environment right now. I just can remember all these workshops I'd sit in, and it was about bullying or suicide prevention and all these things, and everybody would say the same thing. Connect with your students. Take time to know who they are. Yada da. Meanwhile, they're packing more kids in the classroom. They're telling them what to teach. There's no time to do those things. So I would spend time. Yeah, I believe that's what my job was in the schools. But it didn't resonate with the administrators. You know, it's not quantitative the way that, you know, testing is and stuff. So we have a few teenagers in this choir, and I'd like to do more. I want it to be multi-generational. Even a 9-year-old that loves to sing can come. You know, it's...
We've even had a 4-year-old there toning with us.
Nice.
Yes. The toning is interesting. Our 4-year-old would lay there, and toning is... At first, it sounds really weird, and it's hard to get teens to let go that much and to just... You know, and it sounds loosey-goosey and whatever, but if you just go with the process, some amazing music comes out.
Even technically, you know, with the toning, even though it is kind of the more loosey-goosey aspect of the class, I would say that might have had the most positive effect on expanding my range. Mm. And just because you're just searching with your voice, you can make any sound you want. And
that's
so
what
it's
toning
not
is?
Yeah. And you're making sounds based on how your body might feel at the moment, and then all of a sudden you hear this other sound come from the other side of the room, and then you react to that, and it might be anything from, you know, heavy breathing to screaming or beautiful singing. I mean, it
and
can be
chords.
Anything. And the chords that come out, the harmonies, and it could you could be saying words or singing. You know, you could be making any sound that you want with your body or with your mouth. And for me, that I have found a really huge increase in my range on the upper level, especially because I would let my voice go way up high when I thought it never could do that.
Very.
And it was just like a reaction to something that I heard, and then I just all of a sudden my voice went up there, and I think that having the freedom to just make any sounds you want, or, you know, all of a sudden it's like, oh, I'm going to sound like a siren, or and then you hear somebody else make some sound, and then you react with something really low, and you're doing things with your voice, like it really is a muscle, you know, and you're helping to strengthen it rather than just in your own comfort zone. You're able to expand what is comfortable.
So trained musicians like Angela enjoy this, you know, right brain side of the thing. And then people who crave more structure, you know, say somebody like you maybe who wants, oh, maybe I want to learn how to use my diaphragm, support myself better, and go in ranges that I, you know, so it's kind of split down the middle.
I like that part too, though. I like all of it.
She just wants all of it.
They use their whole brain.
Yeah, and whole body.
It's Angela Gabriel, percussionist, Amy Lindquist, singer, co-directors of the Seventh Wave Community Singers, and they are at the Rail Yard Performance Space every Sunday from 5:30 to 7. The first class is free, and after that it's still quite affordable and low cost for anybody who wants to show up. And I want to thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
This was really fun talking to you about it. Thank you for having us.
I'm very happy to welcome back to the program Tomas Inos. He is the founding director of Milagro Herbs, and he's an instructor at Milagro School of Herbal Medicine. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me back.
It's a long time since you've been on the air.
We just decided pre-2007.
Yeah, because that's when I started archiving the show. But you have been doing this for decades now, studying and teaching herbal medicine.
Right.
And herbal medicine is, for many people, an alternative to prescription medicine, and for many people, a way of preventing diseases that you might have to treat with prescription medicine.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one kind of niche, if you will. It's actually the foundation, of course, of all modern medicine was the study of plants and the therapeutics around that. Actually, about 25% still of pharmaceutical medicines are derived initially from a plant-based material and then synthesized into a pharmaceutical drug. So it still has a large impact in modern medicine. But on the whole, it's, again, holistically based. And so a lot of folks come in that are just maintaining health, maintaining good health, and also herbal medicine's quite effective on chronic illnesses.
Like what?
Like chronic allergies. They're... they tend to recur, whereas a lot of over-the-counter medications or pharmaceutical drugs tend to maybe have some undesirable side effects, whereas herbal medicines work very well with that. And not only that, but we work with the whole person. And so it's not just about necessarily a disease or an ailment. it's more about what's the whole person, what's the root cause, and what are perhaps the contributing factors, and how can we work with that.
Now, in acupuncture, oriental medicine, and in Ayurvedic medicine, there are ways of looking at the whole person that have to do with the four elements or the five elements or the different temperaments or whatever. In the kind of herbal medicine that you do, are there, for example, different body types that you would treat with different kinds of herbs?
Well, exactly, yeah. Actually, herbalism is, of course, a worldwide trade, one of the first needs of human beings. So our approach in Western herbalism, let's say from a European standpoint, the root was we go back all the way into Greece and Egypt, and there were four humors, if you will, or four types of persons and also ailments. So we work with the constitution of the person, what is their makeup, and trying to keep that person within balance. We also incorporate a lot of the ideas and concepts in with Ayurvedic, Chinese, and Mexican herbalism. So we have curanderas that are coming up and teaching with our program. And a lot of it, all of the those herbal trades are holistically based that include the four directions or five directions and the five tastes, and all the things that you find in other traditions are actually in our background in our European history, but they've been kind of pushed to the back or lost over time, but we're recovering them, and this is how we do it through this training programs.
There are so many ways of thinking and doing things. I mean, agriculture, for example, was co-invented in a lot of different places at the same time. It's not like it started somewhere and spread all over the world. And I would think that all the different traditions on every continent have discovered a lot of the same things about similar plants independently of one another.
Exactly. And that's where a lot of the sharing needs to go happens, where we do a lot of course, sharing over the internet, but also at conferencing and sharing and co-teaching so that we find out the commonalities. But there's also another interesting part to it where I've spent a lot of time in Mexico studying with herbal traditions there. And of course, we have this border area between the United States and Mexico, so that's a political boundary, but actually the ecologies are shared in a lot of ways. And so a lot of the plants that are growing in Mexico that also grow in New Mexico, for example, and it might be the same plant growing in both countries, and the uses may be totally different, or they could be the same. But if they're different, then that's kind of interesting, because then there's a whole new set of uses that, for example, they've been using in Mexico that we could learn from and maybe apply,
right,
where we didn't know about before. So there's a lot of sharing that is very important. And the same with Chinese medicine. We have a very similar plants to what are used in Chinese medicine, or the same, and they might have totally different uses and concepts around the uses. So sharing is really important as far as the information goes.
That is very interesting. I remember years ago reading a book by an ethnobotanist who went to the Amazon rainforest, and there were different tribes that lived fairly near each other but weren't on particularly good terms. And he got their medicine people to talk to each other and to see how they use different leaves and different plants. And even people living right next door to each other would use the same plant for two different things.
Yeah, that's very common. You'll find that all over the world. And a lot of times just the separations in political boundaries or social boundaries create separations in knowledge base. And even to the point where you'll find different healers, using a similar plant or the same plant in different ways.
Right.
So even herbalists in the United States may use, for example, marshmallow root, which is a very common plant, in two different ways. And that might be a preference or of theirs, or it might be that something over time that they've learned that just works for them. So there's a lot of variation. We kind of have a common system, but we apply it differently.
Now, you are about to start an 8-month-long course of study for people who want to get more deeply into herbal medicine.
Exactly. And so part of that reason is that there hasn't been an herb school here in Santa Fe for quite a long time. And there's a big need for students, younger people, to get into the trade and get training, because it takes so many years to get the training and to apply it and get experience. And so the demand has been increasing over the years. We've been doing, for the past 2 years at Milagro Herbs, we've been doing one-day workshops, two-day workshops, and so building the capacity and also the interest level. So we've got a lot of students that are interested in going into it as perhaps a career. And since it's holistic and there's so much information to know, we're starting this first year as a foundation course to future study as well.
If you go into herbal medicine as a career, do you have to jump through bureaucratic hoops? Is there kind of certification?
We give a certificate at the end of our training, but there's no formal certification for herbalists. As far as the bureaucracies, authorities, or governments are concerned, their interest is regulating both plants, depending on if something's unsafe or something to be aware of. So they've looked at actual plants, and they also govern the production process. So like clean laboratory techniques, for example, just like you might use in a restaurant, for example, just keep things clean.
Sterilize your bottles.
Right, that kind of thing. Keep things clean and keep records of how things are produced and when they're produced. But as far as the actual individuals, at this point, we have no certification. But we have seen over time what is needed. And what, as far as the training goes, what, according to what a herbalist does, what are the fields that need to be used in that training? So we use botany, of course, which is the identification of plants. We work a lot with agriculture as well, because a herbalist usually wants to grow some of their own medicines to work with. We look at materia medica, which is a study of many different plants, and pharmacy, how to make things.
Yeah.
And then therapeutics, how to apply the knowledge to people.
And there is a dimension of empowerment in it, because if you can grow your own herbs and make your own herbs, you don't have to be utterly dependent on a system that might be out of your price range or that is hard to understand or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's maybe just even for health maintenance and so actually a lot of our students come to learn for their own health and then also to help people around them, like their families, their community. They're not necessarily interested in going into it as a trade or a business, but it goes along well with, for example, we have a massage therapist come and study, and they might want to apply the information along with their other massage trade, or acupuncturist, or any number of folks. Primarily a lot of outdoorsy types that like to get their hands in the dirt, you know, and actually, you know, see what the plants look like, go out in the field. And it's a lot of fun because we spend time out camping in the field and looking at native plants, for example.
And there's a lot of native plants that are really therapeutic and can be used in so many different ways. There's a plant that grows out of the cracks between the sidewalk in front of my house, that if you make a salve out of it, it makes mosquito bites stop itching.
Uh-huh.
And it's just an ugly weed.
Yeah, they're everywhere. Yeah, we work with over 200 different local plants as far as, and on a field trip, a lot of times we'll see 50 plants just in a weekend and talk about the uses for those plants. And then when you include those individual plants and start mixing them with others, you get exponential uses. And so the native plants are here to be used, and the history, if you figure in all the years of the Pueblo cultures and the Hispanic cultures that have been here, the historical uses and applications are it's quite a rich information base.
How has herbal medicine helped your own life, if it has? Do you use herbs yourself a lot?
All the time, you know, every day. And if nothing, most of the time I feel really good. But after dinner, I have a cup of mint tea and to help with the digestion. And a lot of times in the morning, I'll have an herbal tea base, or and during the day, something to drink. And it helps replenish electrolytes and just kind of keep things in balance. And also with our approach to staying healthy with the seasons, which is really critical, if you use herbal teas or medicines according to the seasonal approach, you can avoid some of the common ailments like allergies or cold and flu.
How do you avoid cold and flu?
Well, keep your immune system really healthy and strong. And so in the fall, beginning in about September, really boost your immune system and also protect the throat and lungs.
What kind of herbs are good for that, just for example?
Our primary herb for is Osha, and that's has thousands of years of use in this area. All the local folks know that plant, and it grows way up high in the mountains. And there actually is a similar plant used in Chinese medicine that grows in China to that plant. So, but it's very good at protecting the lungs and purifying the lungs. So, for example, I have a couple pieces in my pocket right now. So if I'm ever feeling like a little tickle in my throat, or like I've been exposed to someone or someone's coughing nearby, and I'll start chewing on a piece of it, and keeps my breath fresh and keeps the bugs from sinking in.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's a fantastic plant, and lots of years of use here. So that's, in the fall we use Osha, and throughout the winter just keep it around. We make preparations with honey. We make preparations with extracts with tinctures of alcohol and water, or just the raw root.
We're talking to Tomas Inos of Milagro Herbs. Now, what about some of the ailments of old age, like arthritis and the kind of stiffness that people get in their joints as they get older? Are there herbs that can either prevent or treat that kind of thing?
Well, there are a number of them. First of all, we look at what's the lifestyle of the person, because arthritis a lot of times might be what we consider to be where the person is too acidic, so they end up with uric acid buildup in the joints, and then there's swelling, inflammation, and pain. And so we look at helping to balance the person, become more alkaline, maybe taking herbs like alfalfa in their diet to alkalize their body. Burdock, dandelion root, for example, are very effective. And then perhaps an anti-inflammatory herb, like a great local plant for that is yerba mansa or yerba del manzo. It's a local root that grows along the waterways. It's very effective for all kinds of inflammation. So we might do a combination of people and then help them understand how they can modify their lifestyle to avoid the problems, or to at least mitigate the heavy impact of pain and swelling.
Do you work also with people in terms of not just herbs, but the diet that they're eating?
Yes, that's very critical, is looking at the diet, and stress level, of course, is a big one, lifestyle, things like even digestive issues are the biggest issues worldwide that herbalists deal with. So upset digestion, all these things called acid reflux that people have. So what's the stress level? Like, what are people thinking or watching, or how are they eating? Are they eating really fast? Or are they drinking ice cold drinks with their meal that might impair digestion? So there are a lot of questions we need to uncover. It's kind of a little bit of a individual detective work.
Yeah.
And asking questions and then making suggestions and try and fine-tune that. And then with that in mind, then the herbs can work better.
It's funny because, I mean, life is stressful. You
always
can't have a non-stressful life unless you're very, very lucky. And I don't even know if you want to call it lucky, because it might be boring if you had a completely non-stressful life. But it's also true that we choose some stressful situations, and when you become aware of that, like I noticed the other day, I was watching a television program that was so gripping and scary. And at the end I was like, you know what, I'm not gonna do that again. It's too scary. This is too much stress on my body. I'm just gonna stop.
Yeah, well, nowadays it's more there's so much stress, we need to pick and choose.
Yeah,
you know, some of it's beneficial, like a lot of times we need a deadline, right, to actually come up with the work, you know, at the deadline. Or, you know, fight or flight kind of thing. when our adrenaline kicks in, that's a common. But when we're under adrenaline stress day in and day out, that just wears down the body, and then we end up, the person usually ends up crashing, and then you have to kind of rebuild them. And I've been through that myself. I did it at a younger age when I was in my 20s, so I'm well aware of that. And
you
I
crashed and burned and came back?
27, yeah. That was a great year.
Really?
Yeah, I did it all.
What happened?
Everything, you know. I did everything that I possibly could have done to enhance my lively experience, and I just crashed, and things just fell apart for me. And I thought I was invulnerable, you know, in my late 20s. And
is that how you got into herbalism?
That's one of the ways that one of the things that helped me get on the path. Very much like I couldn't avoid it anymore. Like, this is it. I was going to either die or get it together. And so I thought, well, this is great. I kind of come from this background. My mother did a lot of vegetable growing and teaching me what she knew about plants when I was young. So it kind of comes natural. I'd rather be healthy than to go through a lot of pain and suffering. And so it's kind of relinquishing our attachment to pain and suffering, if you will, you know, like instead of beating ourselves over the head all the times through too much stress or poor quality food or excess drug intake, recreational drug or whatever it might be that just wears us down. You know, too much friction. It's like driving down the street, one foot on the gas pedal, the other on the brakes.
When you talk about the practices that you do, they seem so simple. You drink your mint tea after dinner. You slow down a little bit. You chew your OSHA root that you keep in your pocket. It's stuff that really doesn't seem like that's going to change your life, but taken together, perhaps it does.
Yeah, and it should be simple at some level. Mint tea is very effective. It's amazingly good. And it helps us sleep at night. If your digestion is good after your evening meal and it's calm, you have a good night's sleep. So how many people do you know, perhaps yourself? I've had it occasionally where you wake up in the middle of the night all the time. Can't get a good night's sleep. Try doing that for a couple months and you really get worn down. And so having good digestion, one of the primary causes of sleeplessness and recurrent wakefulness in the middle of the night is from poor digestion. It's liver gallbladder, if you will. And that's so we work with that just by calming the digestion, not eating too late, but calming it through a cup of mint tea. It makes all the world of difference. And it's so simple. But, you know, we don't hear a lot about that, so.
Right, right. Now, the eight-month course of herbal medicine is starting very soon. And if people want to find out more, well, when is it starting? This spring?
April 2nd is the first day, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's people have a while to register or whatever.
I thought I'd get out now. People are thinking about new things. You know, we're coming into spring. The daylight hours are lengthening, and people think, well, what do I want to do this spring? Something really great and new. So, they can contact us with at info@milagroherbs.com or just call us here in Santa Fe, 820-6321, and we have all the information packet, and we can explain it to folks. Our first class will be limited to 12 people, and so we're really excited about that. And we've got a lot of information to put out for folks.
Tomas Enos is with Milagro Herbs. They're also on the web at milagroherbs.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Thank you.